Welcome to More Food for Thought, the companion show to Food Conversations. More Food for Thought expands on some of the ideas that are aired on Food Conversations. And today I'm in the host chair once again, sitting in for the regular host, Steve Corey, who's had a touch of laryngitis and so is going to limit himself to some announcements and promo mentions and that kind of thing. Today, our guest is a person who plays a central role in the work of the Shuswap Area Family Emergency Society, commonly known as the SAFE Society. An organization has taken on a central role in this community with respect to addressing the issue of family violence and violence in general, not only in our community, but in the region as well. Paige Hilland is Executive Coordinator of Programming and Community Development for the SAFE Society. Welcome, Paige, to More Food for Thought.
Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you here. Now, you came here onto this show through a slightly circuitous means. It had something to do with the Shuswap Food Action Society. Maybe you could just say how that worked, that little pathway that took place.
Sure. So we participate in a number of different collaborative roundtables for different social service providers in the Shuswap, and Shuswap Food Action is frequently at those roundtables. So we started having some conversations just about ways that the work that they're doing can support the work that we're doing at the SAFE Society. So they approached us and were eager and willing to do some sort of partnership, and we spoke frequently about, you know, the challenges and the needs of the people that we serve and how they could assist us with those folks accessing food. So we came up with this idea to do a drive for small kitchen appliances. And the idea is to get small kitchen appliances into the hands of people who need them and give them some tools like recipes to help them cook healthier meals at home.
So you're looking to these appliances and things to be available to people in their own homes rather than necessarily at the shelter.
Yeah, so often we have folks that are starting out fresh. They've left the transition house, or they might be engaged in a number of our other community programs, and they may not have a lot, or they may just be starting over again. So we want to connect them with some tools to be able to cook healthy meals at home for themselves and their children.
This is very congruent with the sort of main statement of mission of the SAFE Society, which I think is quite compelling. It says, people's lives can restart at our front door. That seems to be very much what this program of seeking out donations of appliances is all about. It's at a very fundamental and pretty practical level, helping people to restart things in their own lives.
Yeah, I think we take that mission really seriously, and we recognize that it takes a lot more than just shelter over someone's head to be able to move on and change their life after experiences of violence in their relationship or violence in their home. And so we really try to provide that wraparound support for folks, which includes helping them access food and other really practical needs.
Sure.
Which can make a big difference.
Down to earth stuff. It's not pie in the sky. The society, the SAFE Society, has been operating for getting on 40 years. It's really had a major impact on the community. And it served quite a large area, including Sicamous, Maliqua, North Shore, Sorrento, as well as Salmon Arm and area. And it started out in a hotel room. We won't spend a lot of time on the history because it's pretty well known to a lot of people in the area. But it started out in a hotel room and then rented houses. And then it moved forward in some very concrete ways as support the community group. Maybe you could just outline a little bit of the trajectory to getting the point to the situation now where there's a transition home, a transition house that is really fairly impressive.
Sure. So the SAFE Society was formed. It was at a grassroots level. A number of concerned citizens in the Shuswap community came together because they saw what was happening, violence against women in relationships, and they felt that that was not right. And so they came together collectively and started the society. And yes, we did start in hotel rooms and then rented spaces. We purchased a transition house building that was not purpose-built, but it worked at the time. And then in 2009, we moved into a brand new purpose-built transition house building that was built in cooperation with construction industry professionals, Okanagan College and Sandy Ridge Construction. So that's where we currently are located.
You even had some students working on it as well from School District 83. That's kind of...
Yes, it was a really nice collaboration where they were able to learn and grow their skills, and we got a really wonderful building out of it in the end.
So Paige, maybe you could describe the difference between the house that you purchased, which was not purpose-built, and the transition house now. Obviously, it's got some new features that make it more appropriate.
Yeah, so our new house is wheelchair accessible, which is a big one. So we have wheelchair accessible bedrooms and bathrooms. We're also really privileged to be able to have private bedrooms for each family. So there's no dormitory style, no shared rooms, which I think is really special and really important for people to feel safe and comfortable when they come in. So we also have a really wonderful like outdoor play space, indoor play space for kids. It's really kid friendly with lots of room to move around and get their energy out. So we're very lucky to have the building that we do.
Well, as a family physician, I'm pleased to say that the transition house has moved ahead of my profession. There has been a talk for a long time of having only single rooms or private rooms, as they're called, in hospitals, because when you're ill, the last thing you really want to be is sort of in a dormitory style room with a bunch of other people. So you've I think recognize, the Safe Societies recognize that when you're going through a difficult experience, you need a bit of space for yourself, as well as, of course, the supports that being in a community-based service building offers you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're quite privileged there as well. We've since been able to secure funding to provide 24-hour support staff, which is very helpful for folks that are going through a difficult time. There's always somebody there to support them, to keep the house safe. And that was something in the past. We didn't have any paid support staff. Mm. Then we had support staff, but only during daytime hours. Mm. And so we've been 24 hours a day for quite some time now. And it's really, really
huge,
wonderful.
Makes a huge difference. Absolutely makes a huge difference. Yeah. In addition to the transition house, you also, and this has been built up over the years, have a wide array of programs that cover a lot of areas. I have a list in front of me that practically covers half a page. The community-based victim services, sexual assault support services, outreach, stopping the violence, counseling, community counseling, police-based victim services, and communication and family violence prevention. Those are programs, and there's also projects. Maybe you can talk about what underlies all of them. What's the fundamental message or role or purpose that you see underlying all of that?
Sure. So I think, what came out of the initial women's movement and the creation of women's shelters was the recognition that there's a spectrum of challenges that people are dealing with. And so programs like the what used to be called the Children Who Witness Abuse Program, it's now called the Peace Program for Children and Youth, that arose out of the women's shelter movement, recognizing that there was an impact on children and that they needed specific support services.
And is PEACE an acronym? What does PEACE stand for?
Prevention, education, advocacy, counseling, and empowerment.
I think that's a pretty nice set of principles.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to what the program does. Before, when it was initially started, it was a recognition that children who did witness violence in their homes were adversely affected. And that's where the original name of Children Who Witness Abuse comes from. But I think the name change recognizes that there's actually a really broad spectrum of work that program's doing for prevention, with children in schools, talking about consent, healthy relationships, because the program does work with children from age 3 through to age 18. And so there is a broad variety of different needs that the program's meeting. And so the new name, I think, represents that well.
Sure. As a longtime supporter of the SAFE Society, and also somebody who's been doing in-depth psychotherapy, I see adults who bear the scars of the violence and or abuse and or just dysfunctional interactions in families that occur in their childhood, but they have to work them through as adults because the impact is still with them often. It's sometimes leave scars that last for a lifetime.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And we recognize that too. And we want to, part of the work we're doing in prevention is addressing those systemic problems, which often come from different adverse childhood reactions. And that's where some of our work with men or with families, you know, are really focused on that prevention work as well, and not not only supporting the survivor, but we want to support families to be okay and to recover and move on and be happy and healthy, productive members of society.
Now, the SAFE Society, in terms of its operational activities, is not it's a group effort, as all the best things in life are. And it includes, right now, you have 21 people who you are employing. You also have a volunteer board, and you have students who come and get mentored by somebody within the society. Why don't you just break that down a little bit, Paige? Who's doing what in that sort of mix?
Sure. So we are a registered charity. So as such, we have members, and then we have a volunteer board of directors. And then we are very lucky to have over the years added funding and been able to have paid program staff operating our programs, which is wonderful. People are extremely well-educated and professional and delivering high-level support services. And then part of the work that we do is also mentoring new folks coming into the work. And one of the ways we do that is through practicums. So usually every year we take two practicum students from Okanagan College from the Human Service Work Program. We've also taken practicum students from UBC Okanagan teaching schools and other social work practicums in our counseling programs and things like that. So we're always open to doing practicums with people and hiring young folks that want some experience, because I think it's a great way to get skills and experience. And I started as a young person, and doing the work really opened my eyes to, a lot of challenges that were happening in our community.
We're going to take, in a moment, we're going to take a break so Steve can make some announcements. But I want to point out that the background of the community is important, and people also have complicated lives. And today we were going to have Jane Shirley join us, but she's had a canine problem. She has a dog who's very ill, and she couldn't join us today. And I think I just want to mention that because it shows how important caring is in so many ways. We care for people, but we need to care also for our companion animals, and we need to care for the environment around us. So that's very much part of the matrix in which the SAFE Society operates. Let's talk a little bit about how you yourself got involved, because you studied at university, and you studied in an area that one would say would suit you very much for becoming involved in the SAFE Society's work, a degree in political science and women's and gender studies. How did you come to that, and what was it that made that such an important issue for you?
Yeah, so I can't say I ever necessarily envisioned myself doing the work that I'm doing, but I started out university quite young and ambitious. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I went to university. I had no idea what I was going to study.
Good for you. I love that. That's the way many of us are in our lives, even in advanced years. So you went on.
And I took my first women's studies class, and it it blew my mind a little bit, shook my beliefs in my core. And I left thinking, you know, oh my goodness. But it was something that was really interesting to me. And so I ended up pursuing that along with political science. I graduated and I was still fairly young, wanted to take a bit of a break. And my plan was to go back and go to law school. So I actually applied for a position with the Safe Society. Jane Shirley interviewed and hired me for a casual position at the Transition House. And I thought, oh, I'll do this for a couple of years and then continue on with my education. And again, I kind of had one of those moments where my mind was blown, a little expanded, and I just never stopped.
So you've described two moments in which your mind was blown. What was the first moment in the studies that captured your attention, that made you think, this is something worth pursuing?
I think I've always kind of been interested in, question things like gender roles and, why, and from a young age, sure. Why do we expect women to behave certain ways and men to behave certain ways? And it never quite sat well with me, but I didn't have the language to really understand that. And so through my schooling and my studies, I started to gain some perspective on things like gender and then how things like gender roles really impact our communities and how they actually underpin things like violence and ideas about, right. masculinity. And right. It's a big subject that
for sure.
we've talked about for a long, long time. But I think that's kind of what... started the passion in me. And then when I got the job at the Safe Society, it was an opportunity to actually do something about it.
Yes.
And make a difference. And so, an issue that was really important and impactful to me, I still am able to go to work every day and feel like I'm making a difference in that problem, which to me is a really incredible opportunity. And I'm really grateful to still be doing the work over 10 years later.
It makes it seem a lot less like work when you really enjoy yes. going to your job every morning, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So now, frontline work for about eight and a half years. Mm-hmm. It's been a process, though. You've gone through several stages. What were those stages that you went through and where did it eventually end up?
Yeah, so when I was hired, it was casual. So I worked the night shifts and the Christmas days and the weekends.
That's where the starting workers go, night
yeah,
shift.
Yeah, yeah. Emptied garbages, and I still do those things. We're a small team, but
yes.
So I worked casual, and then I eventually worked a permanent position, and then I was really lucky to have the opportunity. I took over coordinating the Transition House program, and then I moved into my current role. Couple years ago, just about. As our agency really grew and expanded, we added programs. Jane, as our executive director, there was a lot on her plate, and we were in a place of growth, and so we were able to add my program or my position in, and sure. I moved into that role.
The organization is growing, and I know from conversations with you and with Jane that support from the community plays a critical role. It's support in multiple forms, but maybe you could break down the sort of basic financial support, just the proportions that come from, say, individual donations, from grants, from large donations. I know that there's a fairly established pattern there. Maybe you could just briefly give us a sense of what that involves.
Sure. So our programs, most of our programs receive funding from some sort of government ministry. So the Transition House is funded through BC Housing, and then most of our other outreach programs are funded through the Ministry of Justice and Crime Prevention Branch. And those ministries have been renamed throughout the years, but that's what they're currently called.
Yes.
And then we received some other funding through different contracts, through different government ministries. So, and then we do rely substantially on donations, especially in the transition house. I believe it's 10% of our budget annually. We rely on financial donations. And then we also rely a lot on donations of items. So people donating household goods or non-perishable food items, those types of things really help with our budget. We're able to stretch our food budget a lot farther for healthier, fresh items when we are getting non-perishable items donated.
We're going to talk a little bit in terms of the impact of COVID-19 on many aspects of your program, but maybe we could talk a little bit about the donation center. There's two locations, as I understand it. There are physical locations and what they take in and how they take it in, because it's a little different from, say, the sort of store and garage sales. It works in a very particular way. Maybe you could describe that.
Sure. So we've always relied on donations through a donation center. So clothing, small household goods, and sometimes food and other items for children. And we used to operate that out of our transition house building. And we've done that for years and years and years, and it's always been really needed and really well received. We're able to help people when they're leaving the transition house and setting up their own home. We're able to support people after they've left and they can come and get items they need, and also get support from our trained support staff. And then we also, during COVID, had to rethink this idea, because obviously a transition house building, there's vulnerable folks living there, and we had to limit the number of people coming in. So we transitioned to kind of doing an outdoor donation pickup, and then we were able to secure some temporary grant funding to rent a space downtown, and we've moved the donation site to an off-site location to keep the people in the transition house really safe. And because we moved to this new location, we're able to open a little bit longer hours and give more away. So that's also why we're able to do this partnership with Food Action. We have space, and we have the ability to take the things in and sort them really well and give them out from there too.
Let's perhaps focus a little bit on that linkage between the Food Action Society and the availability and the necessity for food for the people who come to the transition house. It's obviously an important part of everybody's life, having access to food, having food that you don't have to spend money that you don't have in order to obtain. Could you describe that sort of aspect a little bit?
Sure. So, I mean, there's obviously a number of food banks and food charities in the Shuswap that all do really incredible work. And, we do not want to be a food bank, but there is still a need that we meet for people that isn't met through traditional means. And that's why we continue to give food to people. There's always emergency situations. Our transition house is a 24-hour a day facility where people can call and or drop in and get assistance. And so I think even just our ability to respond 24 hours a day is really important. So we can give food to people that are in emergency situations. Community members will phone us, or one of our programs is like police-based victim services, for example, responding to an emergency and needing some food items for someone. We can respond to those kind of crisis needs. But then there's also just a large portion of folks that engage with our services that are not engaged with traditional food services. And that can be for reasons of confidentiality or guilt or shame, or they're just not sure where to go. Mm-hmm. So we kind of meet that need in the middle. And then we always encourage and work with folks to come up with a more sustainable long-term plan, which can include accessing food banks. Sometimes people just need a little bit of assistance and encouragement and information from our program. Right. So we try to help them out in the interim, and then get them connected with a longer-term plan.
Respect to that, these variations on how you're bringing food into the community, there's some subtle but significant differences between how you do it and, say, a traditional thrift store does it that plays into some of the things you're mentioning about things like confidentiality and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's different beliefs about giving items out, and we just always try to respect people's needs for confidentiality. It's a small town. We live in a very small community, and confidentiality is so critical for people, especially in the initial stages of leaving a violent relationship. They need confidentiality, and you know, they may not be able to have the assurance of that when they're going to their places, whether that's, you know, folks that are working or volunteering there, or, you know, just bumping into their partner or someone they know in those places. And Sure. And a lot of times it's just people just feel a level of shame, and it takes them some time to process that and work through it and feel comfortable and confident. So
And that's probably a responsibility that rests on all of us as well, to make sure that we don't engender any feeling of shame or embarrassment in people who are in a situation that many of the people who are clients of yours find themselves in. I think it's a broad responsibility. I'd like to focus on how COVID has had an impact on the work you do and the behavior of people in the community that is relevant to what you do. Clearly, pretty well everyone's life has been affected by this condition, and I wonder if you could outline, Paige, how it has impacted both your work and the lives of the people that you try to help.
Sure. I mean, again, this is a big topic, but we can definitely try to cover it in some.
We will not expect you to come up with the solutions.
Oh, good. So I mean, we've certainly seen the effects of COVID-19 in our sector. You know, there's a lot of concern about pandemics and isolation and increasing violence against women. There's lots of research and international studies from other countries that have experienced pandemics before that have seen spikes in violence in relationships during pandemics. So we definitely were aware of that possibility, you know, when COVID-19 was first affecting us in Canada. And I think the primary reason for that is isolation. And obviously, isolation is a big part of COVID-19. We're asked to stay home and not see our friends and family. And a lot of support services were closed down or impacted by the pandemic.
So there's been isolation from the community at large, and there's been increased proximity within families and relationships. It's this isolation from the normalizing or normative influence of society as a whole, and then this intensification of personal relationships.
Yeah, and I mean, violence in relationships is based on power and control. And so when a person is home with their spouse 24 hours a day, that's a pretty drastic increase in control. And it makes it extremely difficult for people to even reach out to support services because their partner is constantly with them. And then additionally, there's just been an increase in stress on people and families. So, you know, with the pandemic, closures of things, I think we can all understand that there's been this increase in stress. And so that can have a big impact on violence in relationships too. When any sort of stress happens in a family, that's when risk for violence, either frequency or severity, escalates. And that's something we actually look at when identifying highest risk violence is stressors like that.
What about lines of communication between your staff and your outreach services and people in the community? Obviously, if I will say, a woman is at home and her partner is there with her all the time and things are breaking down. How has this resulted in necessary creative ways to try and get in touch with you? How has that affected things?
Sure. I mean, we've pretty quickly had to, you know, everyone uses the word pivot, but that's what we did. You know, obviously doing, you know, Zoom support services with someone, if their spouse is in the home, can be challenging. Some people just don't have access to technology to be able to do Zoom and virtual things like that. So we've come up with creative ways to connect people with phones, with computers. We have a computer lending library. We were able to receive grants to be able to do that. And we also launched an online chat service as an extension of our regular crisis telephone line, because we were recognizing that it's really difficult to phone and talk to somebody if your partner's in the same room as you. But you may be able to go online. You know, most people have some sort of device these days. So on our website, we have a private chat function now. From 10 a.m. to 10 p.m., people can chat with the same support workers they would get on the crisis telephone line.
This is a rural community, and there are a number of, we also have a high proportion of seniors, and the idea that stresses in relationships occur in younger couples is not necessarily true. There can be older folks who are in difficulty. I'm just trying to be the devil's advocate and think, okay, if you don't have a laptop and you're not used to computers and you may not even have a cell phone, and I have some patients who have neither cell phone nor laptop nor any sort of the modern devices. I know this is probably a small subset of the people you deal with, but what solutions have you been working on for those kinds of situations, which must be more extreme?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a portion of people that don't have access to technology. I want to recognize our programs and our staff that have been incredibly creative and adaptive. They've continued to work throughout the pandemic. All of our programs are essential services, so nobody has stopped during COVID. And their jobs have gotten harder and the demand for them has gotten harder. Yeah. But we do lots of creative things. You know, if we can connect people with a phone, like give them a phone. We've received phones donated through a number of places with SIM cards and data. Like I mentioned, device lending.
Speaking of that, would that be a specific thing that right now would be particularly valuable to receive as a donation, like a cell phone?
Yeah. We always take cell phones, because any cell phone can be used for a 911 emergency phone, sure. Even if there's no plan on it. If anyone wants to contribute to access to technology, that's always beneficial for the people that we work with.
I have a couple of old cell phones at home. I've been wondering what to do with them. I think I may have an idea now.
Yeah, just make sure you wipe your personal information.
Yes, indeed.
Before donating. Yeah. But yes, back to what your original question, too. Sure. Some of our programs have been meeting people in public. We've opened new office spaces to allow for social distancing. So we've responded and adapted, and we just need to continue to meet the need in the community because it didn't go away, and it actually increased during the pandemic.
Have you had fluctuations as there's been from governments, both provincial and federal, there's been evolution of programming and suggestions and recommendations and even the mandatory orders? Has this, taking that word pivot and expanding a little bit, has this meant that you're kind of wending your way through a bit of a circuitous path sometimes in terms of adapting to the changing climate of the changing kind of regulatory and policy climate? Put it in very technical terms.
Yeah, for sure. And we've definitely seen impacts from things like the postponement of court, so family court, criminal court. There's been a hesitancy to put people in jail. So, for example, breaching protection orders, the impact of that on the people we work with is that there's not there's not much of a follow through with the court system right now because of the concerns over COVID. You know, there's been lots of challenges with lots of different other agencies adapting to COVID and the impacts on the people that we work with.
The change in court function sounds to me like a particularly threatening thing for many of the people that you work with. If the installation of a protective barricade, even though it's just a legal enactment, is not available, I mean, there is a certain amount of force in the law just by its enunciations, but the fact that many of the people that come to you for help would not be able to specifically invoke that kind of protection, it must be devastating for some of your clients.
Yeah, it's really difficult, and it's really difficult to safety plan with people when that important piece is not as powerful as it once was. We have to be very creative. And ultimately, the stress of that is on the shoulders of the people that we work with and their families that are impacted. You know, they continue to be fearful, have to uproot their lives because of an ongoing threat that is not being managed as effectively during the pandemic as it would normally be.
One of the things that I understand is part of your work is coordinating the support service that people receive. And along the way, and before we came on air, you had made a comment about the fact that knowing what isn't available is part of what you end up having to do and how sometimes limited the support services are. I know COVID has obviously has accentuated some of those problems, but maybe you could expand a little bit on the gaps in support services that of course you try to fill in, but that are still significant even with your best efforts. What kind of things just don't seem to be available?
Sure. So, I mean, we work on a number of different coordination initiatives to try and, you know, improve or reduce those gaps. So there's things like the ICAT table, which is for highest risk domestic violence,
Maybe just explain what ICAT stands for.
Sure. So it's the Integrated Case Assessment Team.
Okay.
And this is a provincial model. It actually originated in Vernon after there was a pretty horrific case of family violence there. Mm. But the idea is that anti-violence agencies like ours work in close collaboration with the police, MCFD, the Ministry of Children and Families, Interior Health, and other support services, including corrections as well. Mm. So we work in close collaboration to identify cases of highest risk domestic violence or potential highest risk, and take steps to reduce that risk and keep people safe. So that's a really great collaborative model. We also do community collaboration around more systemic challenges. So talking about violence in relationships with the broader social service network. So, and that can include anyone, you know, providing food services, mental health services for children. It's a really, really broad network of folks that come together to talk about, you know, where are the gaps for people? We're not talking about specific cases, but in the system, where are the problems? And can we work together to reduce some of those? And can we develop relationships as service providers to make the path smoother for folks? And that's what we want to do. And that's what the Safe Society does within our agency. And that's one of the benefits of having so many services under one umbrella, is it's really can be a seamless experience for people. You know, if they're in the transition house and they need a different support service, our staff work really closely together to kind of smooth that transition from one service to the next.
It sounds like you spend a lot of time in what would be broadly called liaison work, like connecting to other organizations, to other services, to other groups. The definition of coordination, of course, is having a lot of different services working on the same problem. Mm-hmm. Does the Safe Society play a central role, or do you sort of play a role among peers, other organizations? Do you draw them into your bailiwick, or do you have this sort of ongoing structural relationship with these other organizations that's kind of day-to-day sort of stuff?
I mean, I think it depends on which context you're speaking of, but I mean, that's a huge part of my role, and that's where that community development part of my long title comes from, is working in collaboration with community, which is a huge job. And, you know, everyone in our agency works in collaboration, and we work at a number of different tables and different levels. So the Safe Society is definitely a driving force behind violence and relationships collaboration, which we have the Shuswap Violence and Relationships Committee, ICAT. We have a Sexual Assault Coordination Committee, and we have a CRN, which is a Community Response Network, which responds to elder abuse and abuse of other vulnerable persons. But then we also participate in a number of other collaboratives that are driven by different agencies, whether it's around food. We sit on the City of Salmon Arms Housing Task Force, the Social Impact Advisory Committee. So there's a number of different ways we collaborate.
This sounds like holism. This sounds like a holistic approach to me. One question I wanted to ask you is, do you have staff in any respect in your organization who are men? I know everybody knows that the overwhelming responsibility for violence rests on men, that if you look at violence in relationships, it's 95% male versus 5% women. Do you have men participating in active ways among your staff?
Yeah, we definitely recognize that the predominant people experiencing violence are women. But it's also trans and non-binary folks as well are at increased risk. So we do have male staff, specifically really beneficial to have male staff in programs like our peace program for children, working with young men and young people. That can be a really critical role. And throughout the years, we've had a number of men work in that program. We also happily invite men to be on our board of directors. And a lot of our programs do serve men. And I think most people don't understand that. You know, if you are impacted by violence in a relationship or sexual abuse, our services will assist you. And all of our services will, whether that's counseling or victim services. The transition house can support you.
And there's abundant evidence as well that men who have themselves been recipients or the experienced violence and or had violence modeled for them in their early years are at much higher risk for engaging in violent behavior or dysfunctional behavior in themselves later on. Paige, we've covered a lot of territory, but there's a current program that is a sort of large-scale program. It's a three-year program focused around sexual assault. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that as we move on towards the end of the program. Tell listeners how that's structured and what you're doing.
Sure. So, yeah, we're really excited about this program. It's definitely an enhancement of support services, and it addresses a very big gap that's existed in our community for a long time. So a few years ago, we started doing some coordination work around sexual assault and brought together a group of folks that would be involved or interested in intervention.
Can I just who those players would be? Like what sort of service did they represent?
Yeah, so our Sexual Assault Response Committee, we call it. It's composed of a number of different Safe Society programs, RCMP, representatives from healthcare, so a lot of people from hospital and other healthcare. We have counselors that work in sexual assault intervention counseling, private counselors, Okanagan College counselors, and representatives from the student union, Shuswap Immigrant Services. I'm sure that I'm forgetting someone.
Any representation from the education community?
Not at this time, but we would definitely be open to that. And, you know, we're still looking and reaching out to people to really diversify who's at that table. And I would say education would be great to have represented.
Well, I hope there's a school principal or a school administrator listening to the program this morning is taking notes.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me a call if they are.
Yes, right away. So there you are. It's a 3-year program.
Yeah, so out of that, the Safe Society was able to apply for some grant funding for a 3-year program. So this money was from the province of BC, and it was administered through the Ending Violence Association of BC, which oversees a number of our different programs that we offer already. So they administered $10 million over 3 years to 23 different agencies in the province. So there was a general service stream, and then there was Indigenous specific sites. Mm. So we were one of the lucky few that were able to secure funding. And the intention of this funding is to enhance our emergency response to sexual assault in the Shuswap. Because right now our capacity, or prior to this funding, our capacity was quite limited. Transition house programs had limited staff, and our victim service programs didn't operate after hours. And so we recognized there was a big gap for people who needed support and weren't necessarily sure if they wanted to report to the hospital or report to police. So we wanted to create a support service that people could get support that's not tied to medical or healthcare services. They could get information and be supported to hopefully make the decision to access healthcare, but understanding, you know, what that process looks like and having somebody there with them.
So what would the mechanics of this, what you've described, kind of a rapid response, how does that work? How is that working?
Sure. So we created this program as an offshoot of our community-based victim services program. So they can provide a lot of the same support services that community-based victim services does. So legal support. And then they also have a really key role in doing something called third-party reporting, which is an anonymous reporting option. So someone can make a report to a community-based victim service worker, and that information is shared anonymously with RCMP. So if the person does not want to come forward, but they want to share information that can help keep the community safer, this is a really good way that they can do that.
So does that person tell you, do you know who they are, but you don't pass their name on to the RCMP? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so there's a really detailed protocol for this, and there's a specific series of questions that the victim service worker would ask the person. And those questions were created with RCMP E Division, which is the provincial authority that oversees the RCMP.
Right.
So there's predetermined questions. The questions are answered. And then the victim service worker is the only person who knows the identity of the complainant. And then they pass the information on to the RCMP in a neutral de-identified way. Mm-hmm. And then if the RCMP need to follow up, they have a mechanism to do that as well, because they can follow up with the victim service worker, who would then follow up with the person who's made the report. So in terms of accessing the service, people can self-refer at any time by calling the office phone number. But if they need 24-hour crisis assistance, they would call the Transition House Crisis Line, which is 250-832-9616. And then the staff would connect them with a sexual assault support worker.
So it's a service designed to be there at the moment it's needed, not at some place down the road where you phone and you make an appointment and you come later and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a huge gap that was identified in coordination is, you know, who has the capacity to do this 24-hour response? And a lot of times it was tied to, you know, hospital or police. And there is a lot of hesitancy with people in accessing services like that. And we know, like, the vast majority of people never report a sexual assault to the police. And many, many folks don't receive health care. So we want to positively impact that too, connect people with supports, and then hopefully with a supportive person present, they could access things like healthcare and or make a report to police should they want to.
It's interesting how central what you're describing, how central access is in what you're describing. One of the things that's happened in general with respect to health support services is that they tend to be nowadays available only through one channel. If it's out of hours, it tends to be the emergency room, and the emergency room is a busy place because so many people with their problems are focused on going there, that in the middle of all that, to have somebody who's gone through a very traumatic experience or needs to work through the reaction to a very traumatic experience, that isn't readily available even through the standard emergency support services. So that's the gap that you are hoping to fill in. Somebody has come through a difficult, traumatic experience. They can call a number. Why don't you say that number again?
250-832-9616 is our crisis line.
Okay, everybody who heard that number. There's an opportunity for them to deal with it, not the next day, not in a week, not, you know, under some kind of very tortuous kind of process. They can go straight to a support person and get the process moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a daunting and intimidating process on the best of days, and specifically if you've just experienced a traumatic event, you need support. And I think most people are surprised to learn that there's limited options for that type of support in our community.
I can assure you, as a physician, I have become more and more aware of it over the years as access has become quite a significant issue with respect to healthcare in general. The nature of what you do is also reaches out in a different way, and this has something to do with immediate access to services, but also kind of follow-up processes. If somebody is in a difficult situation, the difficult situation has been addressed. They may end up in the transition house for a time, but that isn't the end of their what they have to deal with. And one of the parts of that is secondary housing, second stage housing. I know that Jane has, Shirley, your executive director, has been talking about that for years with various kinds of regulatory bodies and authorities and government agencies. How is that coming along? Because once a person has this access to rapid support and rapid promulgation of solutions, then there's the transition process, which the transition house is appropriately named to address. But then there's the aftermath, where, by the way, of course, donations of food and small appliances and one thing and another is also an important part. So how's that coming along, and where does it need to go that it hasn't gone yet?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, we recognize that it takes a long time for people to move through these processes, and the limited time that they stay in a transition house doesn't always meet that need. There can be need for ongoing support, and that's where second stage housing comes from. The Safe Society has long had this as a goal of ours, to build second stage housing. There's been some recent announcements from the province of BC for additional funding for transitional and second stage housing. We've applied for that funding, and we've been told that we meet the requirements to build it, but we're waiting. we're waiting on the province, and we're looking to identify appropriate land and places we could construct that housing. But we continue to move forward on that project, and I believe we will see second stage housing in our community soon.
We just have a couple of minutes, Paige, and I wonder if you could maybe tell us of one incident, one circumstance, one, relationship that really, over the years you've been involved with the Safe Society, would stand out in your mind as emblematic of why this work is so important.
So I know that you asked me this in our pre-interview, and I've thought about it a lot. And there's so many stories. Like every day that I was doing frontline work, and I still now, there's stories every day. And not everybody has to be like this poster child of a changed life. I think every day we get to witness really inspirational changes that people are making, and And sometimes they're small, and sometimes it takes many years. But I think it's pretty incredible. And I'm inspired by, I mean, every person that I've worked with inspires me and continues to inspire me.
Well, I think that is probably as good as an individual story. You didn't become a lawyer so far, Paige, but I think you'd make a great lawyer if you ever did, and the work you're doing with the Safe Society.